accomplish something when I do that. Proverbs 10, verse 20. We got a two in there for you, Julian. Let's start there, shall we? Good reminder for all of us is we're on the downhill side of this thing called residency, and as you guys start looking to the future, and not, this isn't something you can't be doing right now, but just a good reminder. Emily, read that for us, 10:20. The tongue of the righteous. We hear a ton on the tongue, specifically in James and lots of other places in Scripture. I'm not going to speak to the tongue in the sense that maybe the sense that James does, but what does it mean that the tongue of the righteous is as choice silver, in the contrast with maybe the wickedness, a heart of wickedness is worth little. What's the imagery there? Look maybe at 21 to give you a little bit more of a hint. The lips, or maybe even the tongue of the righteous, feeds many. What's somebody with a righteous tongue able to do with those around them?
The message that they speak is worth its weight in silver.
Yeah, I think that's kind of the idea there. They have the ability to feed, to give life, right, because of what comes out of their mouth. In our world, obviously, there's some very practical ways that we can do that, but thinking through our studying of the Word of God, and us to be able to take a walk with God and transfer that knowledge and wisdom and insight and failures and successes into the lives of other men and women, you guys have the ability to do that. Doesn't necessarily take some program like this to do it. Hopefully this is going to be helpful for you guys in the long run of things, but something that you guys need to think through for the rest of your life. If gals, I came to you and said, who are the women in your life? Who are the women that you're pouring into, that you're discipling, that you're intentionally spending time with in some type of relational connectivity? Guys, same for you. Who are the dudes that you're rubbing shoulders with, that you're climbing mountains with, spending time in the backcountry, snow skiing, sitting over a cup of coffee, programming with, right? Whatever your thing is, and pouring the Word of God into them, and pouring your life into them. We should always have people around us that we're investing in that regard, okay? And you guys have the ability, because of a walk with God, to breathe life into people. You don't need a seminary degree, per se. You don't need to be smarter than the next guy. But some of you guys in this room are wicked talented, and you've got people skills off the charts. Spend your life investing in the things that ultimately are going to last. The Word of God and the souls of men are the things that are going to be around long after you and I die. And if you make your investment in those sorts of things, to be putting deposits into the lives of men and women who are going to be able to carry that message on, then your life will be well lived. Okay? So just remember that. There shouldn't be ever a point in our lives that we're not spending time intentionally, to some degree or another, investing in other people, because ultimately those are the things that are going to last, right? Our bank accounts, our cars, our houses, all that other stuff is going to, it's going to be gone, right? And they're going to have nothing to show for it. So whether you're a mom with young kids and you're investing in your children, if you're a single gal and you're spending time with collegians, if you're a dude that is married and you're spending other time with married men, if you're a single guy and you're hanging out and doing youth ministry or college ministry, whatever station of life God has you, it's going to look different in different seasons. But be investing in the generations to come, all right? And your, hopefully, life will be like this, that you are a blessing to those around you, and your lips, your tongue will feed many. Thoughts on that? Yes, ma'am. There's seasons, Jane, that I've probably done this better than others with intentionality. So obviously I think one of my gifts is teaching. So one of my favorite environments is getting to pour the Bible into you guys. This isn't obviously a discipleship relationship, you know, where I talk for an hour and a half and you sit there and listen. That's not discipleship. And we don't share life at the level that we could or is necessary to have a true discipleship relationship. But for me now, I think in some of the seasons I'm in, I mean, my first priority is, you know, wife and kids and investing in them and hopefully spending time with them. But yeah, I need to have guys around me as well. That was a habit that was easier in single years, maybe in college and stuff like that, when it was readily available. But yeah, it's certainly something I've tried to do. And that movement for me from being poured into to being the guy that's supposed to be pouring into others was nerve-wracking, to say the least, but realizing that, man, I didn't have to have it all figured out or what have you was freeing, I think, a little bit in that process. But, yeah, so different seasons just look different, being a mentor to guys going through regen or whatever it may be. Like, those have been pockets of seasons where I've been able to do that. So, anyway, does that answer your question a little bit? How's that look for you, Jane? And it looks and feels different, right? When full-time was 12 or 15 hours a week or whatever, college was different. And not that that's, you know, some people were working 70, 80 hours a week in college, right, with everything else. So it looks different in different seasons, and I think we need to allow ourselves grace to do that. You know, when my wife was younger and we had younger kids, man, the reality of discipling a woman and even having an intelligent conversation for her at times is like not going to happen, with sleepless nights and those sorts of things. And man, her main role in our home is pouring into our kids, and that's okay. Now, that's not to say she doesn't do it outside of that, but I think for that to be the highest value is right. So know that in different seasons for all of us, that needs to look different, but it needs to be a value. It needs to show up on a radar somewhere, right? So, but yeah, I think grace in the midst of that is good.
Usually you don't hear the silver tongue being used in a positive way. This is interesting for me, because normally it's like, a person got a silver tongue, silver tongue devil or whatever.
Ah, I gotcha.
I don't have any questions.
Just making an observation. Yeah, I haven't maybe thought through that through the negative, so anyway.
That's the other side of the double-edged sword.
Gotcha. We're going to see that sword this morning.
Is there any relation between how it says the tongue of the righteous and the heart of the wicked?
Yeah, I think that's the idea of what's the source of both, right? Those are comparisons. So you're comparing the tongue and the heart as if they're the same or similar. So yeah, it's what's coming from inside. The heart is at the root of all of that, right? And the tongue feeds or is like choice silver, but the heart of the wicked person doesn't feed, doesn't give, doesn't, it takes, it does the opposite. It's useless, worth little. So, yep, totally. Okay? So noodle on that, gang. All right? With that, let's head back into Joshua. That's on the other side of Exodus. Come on, Mike. We're in the midst of the battle of Ai. So we'll hop back into that and kind of see how far we get this morning as we continue to conquer the land and see kind of God's plan for them. Sean, will you pray for us, my friend, and then we will dive back in.
Dillard, we thank you for this morning. And thank you for the opportunity just to simply be here to read your word and understand it a little bit more. Thank you that we're here together as a community. And thank you for Mike and his ability to teach. And I pray that it would be your word that we understand. Light our hearts and our minds. As we move forward. Amen.
Amen. All right. So, obviously started yesterday, big picture Joshua, theme of the book is success, right? That's the idea. They're going to move into the promised land, and for the most part, are going to do pretty well. We're going to see pieces in Joshua where there was incomplete obedience, which we've talked about before is basically disobedience, and the shrapnel that causes or comes from the result of that in the book of Judges and the problems that are going to occur because of the lack of obedience. They start well, they just don't finish the task, okay? First five chapters were all about preparation to conquer the land. God's getting their hearts ready, getting them in the right spot, talking through what it's going to take. We see, obviously, the journey into Jericho with the spies. And then in chapter 5, we saw the circumcision of the people. God's crazy backwards battle plan, but that's it. Circumcise all the fighting males. But he's asking them to trust and to obey him in the midst of what seems like a really poor strategic decision, but that's God's plan for them. Okay. Chapter 6, we saw them take down Jericho, marching around the city quietly. God blowing the shofar through the lips of the high priest, right, to call that the land that is originally his would go back to its original owners, just like in the year of Jubilee. They take down Jericho in an amazing victory. The problem is chapter 7. They got a little cocky, right? They look at AI, they go spy out the land again. They say, hey, you don't need to spend a bunch of people. Only send a few. The problem is we had a guy by the name of Achan who decided to take some things from under the ban that they weren't allowed to take in the battle of Jericho. Okay, Joshua is unaware of it at this point. Goes to God and says, Lord, what the heck? Why are we getting defeated in this battle? Why did 36 men die? And God basically says to him, hey, get up, man. You should be able to figure this out. Get your spiritual radar a little bit more in tune. We finished right in the middle of that story, right, that Joshua is told by God that Israel has sinned. The problem is with one dude. We saw the Urim and the Thummim thrown. We narrowed it down all the way to Achan or Achan. I found out this is the guy that's the problem. And then 7:21, we see him confess the whole process, right? I saw, I coveted, I took, right? The same way that you and I are enticed and led into to sin. When we blow it, this is the same process. Nothing's changed from Eve to Achan to you and I, okay? Now, 7:22, Joshua's going to have to deal with this sin, okay? And here are some harsh consequences for a guy. So, gentlemen, think about the spiritual leadership weight of this decision. Joe, pick up there in 7:22.
When Joshua sent messengers, and they ran to the tent, and there was hidden in his tent with the silver underneath.
So he confessed in 21, or up above that, I guess it was, about this mantle from Shinar, probably Babylon, some type of like really cool statue, I don't know, and a bunch of cash, right? So that's what he took. They found it again in his tent, right where he told them. Keep rolling, Joe.
They took the things from the tent and brought them to Joshua and all Israelites and spread them out before the Lord.
All right, so his sin is laid bare before everybody. Keep rolling.
Then Joshua, together with the Israelites, took Achan, son of Sarai, the silver, the robe, the gold wedge, his sons and daughters, his cattle, donkeys, his sheep, his tent, and all he had to the valley of Archer.
Okay, so Achor and Achan both mean trouble. They're from the same root word. So the troubler, Achan, gets brought to the valley of trouble with who? His whole family. And his donkeys and his sheep. And his gold and everything. Joshua said to him in 25, why have you achened us? Why have you troubled us? The Lord will trouble you this day. And Israel stoned them with stones. And they burned them with fire. And they had stoned them with stones. So he and his whole family, his daughters, his sons, his parents, or not his parents, his wife, his sheep, his cattle, all of it gets stoned. And Aaron, when I say stoned, I mean like thrown rocks at, just so we're on the same page with, okay?
Yes. Wait, what?
Yeah. Come on, that was way funnier than that. Aaron and I had a miscommunication earlier about what joint means.
Oh.
Now we're talking about getting stoned. Oh. Just making sure we're on the same page.
Oh, that's funny.
Jory, what happened there, man? Did I foul that one off?
See, I didn't get the literal term, so you got it's not a reflection of you.
Hey, John wants to know if there's weed in Texas.
Yes.
Weeds.
Yes.
It's like the Bible Belt.
It's probably some nasty, dirty.
There's plenty. There's plenty where I grew up. In the suburbs of Dallas. Oh, yes. Anyway, so harsh consequence, right? Why would this be the punishment for Achan and his family? Achan's the one that blew it, right?
Because most likely if he's doing it, his family?
Potentially. Maybe with the wife you could make that argument. Like, she's culpable. Maybe she was involved.
This is how serious the situation is.
Yeah. What happened to all of Israel as a result of this? 36 men died because of Achan's sin. It's a big deal, right? I was at a leadership retreat, first church I was at, and this was the message that our pastor taught. You know, to a bunch of volunteers, right? We had all of our life group leaders there, coaches, ministry team leaders. There's a couple hundred people in the room, and he said, man, if we want this church to be used by God, we need to remember that, like, one person can foul up this whole thing, that can stick a wrench in the spokes, and this whole thing can just completely fall apart. It's like, God, thanks for the encouragement, like, right? You could hear a pin drop in the room as we're all thinking through our own lives and that sort of thing, but it's heavy. And this is the chapter with the divine e-break, right? Because one guy chose to willfully and kind of high-handedly disobey God. Now, the heartbreaker of all of this chapter, guess what God's going to do in the battles to follow in terms of the ban? He says, take it all. If Achan would have waited one more battle, at Ai specifically, God says, take the stuff. I just wanted it for the first deal to make sure that you're obedient, that you trusted me. I'm not keeping all of it. This portion was a tithe. The rest of the stuff and all the other 30 cities that you're going to do battle in, you can have it. So it's a hard chapter, okay? Gentlemen, I think that's a good reminder for all of us. The weight of spiritual leadership is significant, and we need to remember that. And we are going to be held accountable, like it or not, for how we lead and oversee our families. Like, we're going to hold an account before the Lord for the gifts that we've been given, how we've stewarded that one day. God is not going to ask my wife how she led me and how I, you know, that's going to be my job, right? To say, Lord, I was entrusted with these blessings, these kids, my bride. Here is how I used the gifts that you've given me to shepherd them, to love them, to support them, to encourage them, to lead them, to set a godly example, to set an ungodly example. Like, I'm gonna hold an account for that one day, okay? And that's a lot of weight. So, like it or not, that's the role we have. So,
I think also to recognize in the scripture, like, it seems a little aggressive in the punishment, but the process that went through, he didn't come forward, he was found out.
Yeah.
And so, understanding his heart in that, maybe he was never remorseful in this. He's like, got caught.
Yeah.
That's how he was remorseful.
Yeah. By the way, as you guys deal in ministry, you're going to have situations like this where you have Achans in your midst. Handle things differently when you have somebody that confesses on their own accord and when they are caught. Those are two very different things, okay? When we see people come forward and say, man, listen, I blew it on their own, and their conviction leads them to that, we handle that much, much differently than we do with people that have to get to a certain point where they're caught. And there's grace on both. It's not that you don't extend them, but just recognize that as you guys are in place of leadership. Yeah. He had to get called out. And by the way, that sin with David lingered for probably 2 years. He led Israel. We'll get there. But it took a guy by the name of Nathan saying, I don't care who you are. I'm going to thump you in the chest and tell you what's wrong because I love you. It's a great story. We need more Nathans, you know. So it's hard. He is setting an example for his whole family. So we don't hear the backstory on that. So I don't know if they're innocent in that or not. But it's a hard consequence. And I think it points to the spiritual leadership. He's overseeing his whole home. So it's a hard one, Emily. I'm with you. It's not an easy text to look at and say, man, are these kids innocent in this? He knew the standard and he disobeyed it, and there comes consequences with that. So, and again, there are times I look at that, some of the stuff that, how God behaves and decisions that he makes, and I go, Lord, I don't understand that. I trust you. I trust your character. I know you're benevolent and you're good, and I know you don't just willy-nilly punish sin, right? You're not just angry at everybody and punishing people that are not deserving of it. But sometimes, man, there's areas in the scripture, specifically in Joshua, that are hard. And I have to lean on the character of God and say, Lord, I trust you, even though I don't understand completely. So get comfortable, y'all, with that tension if you're not already there. So a lot of people will go down the road of, I don't like that. I don't like God. And then you begin to distance yourself from him and his word and the gamut of it. And the whole counsel of scripture has to be true, even if we don't understand it, even if we disagree with it. We still have to submit to it and trust that the God behind that is bigger, smarter, and more loving than we are, and that has a plan that's going to unfold that's good. If he's some ogre God, then that's a different deal. But we know different about his character, and sometimes we have to lean into that when we don't understand the process. So, yeah, Troy.
I think it, too, when we say that we don't like something about God and that implicates us back into the day of the garden, the pride of life and our desires.
Yeah.
Like God.
Yeah. That's good. Yeah. I mean, I yearn for control. I want things the way I want them. And when that rubs on me, yeah, I'm with you. It's good. Kyle?
How do you communicate that tension of just this odd kind of vengeful side of God to people? It might be a conversation for later. But
no, I mean, we're in it, right? That's Joshua. We're going to see cities destroyed. We're going to see more women and children killed. Not like we have maybe in the beginning, but we're going to see that in this book. I think there's this sense that we got to realize that there is no innocent people. There is no sense that we're all born into sin. We're all deserving Genesis 3 of death. God has allowed these people to exist in the land and commit gross immorality for centuries, and he's dealing with it. God doesn't kill innocent people. God doesn't allow innocent people to experience this. So sometimes we just have to reorg and re-understand things and look at it from that lens. Is it harsh? Yeah, it's hard. It's not easy to swallow. And I think we also have to go through the grand narrative of, man, we have to step back, and that's where we need to get to 30,000 feet and say, God is showing the plan of a Redeemer and our need for a Savior and someone to step in and be an advocate to take our sin from us. So the big picture, sometimes we have to remember that God is unfolding that plan, and sometimes there are pieces in that plan that don't make sense, but it all fits in the puzzle pieces together to make the mosaic of what God's trying to communicate. But man, yeah, guys, I'll be honest with you. I wish some of these chapters unfolded differently, right? That there was an easier way to explain this. And I can't apologize for it. But sometimes, man, it is hard to wrap my mind around, Lord, why was that best? How is that good? How can a benevolent, loving God allow that? I don't always understand that. So I'm there with you in the tension. But I have to trust God in the process. I have to trust his character. Listen, my kids don't understand a lot of the decisions that I make, and they don't like them a lot of times when, hey, Callie, you're late again. We've had conversations about this. You're grounded, and you can't go out for whatever reason because, right, that's one example that's on our deal. And your decisions are affecting your sisters and our schedule and these sorts of things. She doesn't always like my decisions. I'm not grounding her because I don't like her. I'm not grounding her because I desire to be mean. I'm grounding her because I'm trying to work on her character now. Grounding somebody and killing somebody is a very different thing, you with me? But my point is, my kids don't always understand the heart of their father either, right? And they have to trust that I want what's best for them, even though what is best for them in my eyes at that moment seems very painful to them and unfair or whatever. So at the end of the day, guys, that's why the character of God is paramount. Who he is what ultimately it's going to give you comfort in the midst of that. On the same side of things is when you're going through suffering and hard times, it's the character of God that you lean into, right? That he loves me. He's good. He will lead me through this. He is my shepherd. Even though my situation sucks, that he'll take me through, okay? So, all right. Keep wrestling with it, gang, okay? Don't let it lead you from a love of God, okay? Wrestle with it. Be honest about it with the Lord, but lean into him in those times, okay? So, Achan and his family is slain. End of chapter 7, a hard reality, but that's where we end up, okay? Verse 26, last verse of chapter 7, they raised him over a great heap of stones that stands to this day, and the Lord turned from the fierceness of his anger. Therefore, the name of that place has been called the Valley of Achor till this day. So there is a memorial built for him because of this as a reminder to Israel, and God's wrath in that moment was satisfied, okay? Now, verse 8, let me show you another picture of God, which is pretty cool. Chapter 8, sorry. Jimmy, pick up there. 8:1.
So the Lord said to Joshua, do not be afraid. Do not be discouraged. Take the whole army with you and go up and attack Ai. For I have delivered into your hands the king of Ai, his people, his city, and his land.
All right, so what's God's very next command to Joshua? What's he say first? Don't be afraid. Why? Because I just killed Achan and his wife and his kids, right? Because of their sin. And God says, don't be afraid. And what does he do? What does he promise them? Yeah. I've given the city into your hands. You need not fear. The penalty for that sin has been paid. I'm not some vengeful, wrathful God that hangs on to wrongs suffered. I haven't put your wrongs in a bank account that I can withdraw later and show to you and rub in your face. You haven't wounded me like sometimes when we get in conflicts and we hang on to past garbage and brown bag, like old conversations, and that's what we call them in our house, right? When you're brown bagging, bringing like leftovers back into a fresh conversation that are from like weeks or months or years ago. Like, God doesn't do that, right? Forgiveness has been stated. It's done. They move on. This, by the way, is how kids are, right? My kids bring over friends. They'll get in a squabble. They'll apologize, instantly move on, and they're playing together like nothing happened, right? Adults don't do that. Adults learn how to be selfish, right? To have those qualities of hanging on to stuff, let sin linger and bitterness. God is not that way. I love you. The sin's been paid. We're moving on. There's nothing in the way of us. So tells the people, go conquer the land, go into Ai, okay? You're going to take only its plunder and its spoil. Verse 2, this is the hard part. You shall take the spoil, its cattle, its plunder for yourselves. You get all the stuff from the city, okay? Had Achan just waited, that had been the case, okay? Now, the battle plan for this city is really cool. Pick up in end of verse 2, he says, set an ambush for the city behind it. So the way God is going to win this battle is different than maybe what we've seen in others or that we're going to see in others. And this is one of the ones that, as we talk about battles that are studied today, this is one. So let me connect the map here and show you. All right. You see that? Jericho's kind of down at the bottom. So this is the Dead Sea right here. They crossed over here. So Jericho is at this point right there. They crossed over. They won this battle. Gilgal, this city right here next to Jericho, is going to become kind of home base for them. Sorry, it's low for some of you guys. Okay, Katie? Sorry, you're looking in the back of it. Okay. This is Ai somewhere over in here. And Joshua says, we're going to set an ambush for the city. Okay. Verse 3, Joshua rose that night. Took 30,000 men, valiant warriors, and sent them at night. So they take 30,000 dudes, and they're going to march into this area of Ai. Okay? Verse 4, we're going to ambush the city from behind it. Do not go very far from the city. I and all the people who were with me will approach the city. Okay? There's going to be 25,000 people that Joshua's going to have in like a main camp, and 5,000 people that he's going to pull out for an ambush. Okay? Make sense?
What was the distance
in? That march, I want to say we're going to see a similar one. That's kind of like almost an all-night deal. So from Gilgal to where do they go next? That's probably like a 7-hour journey. I'm looking at the other city, to Gibeon. Gibeon's a little further, and we'll see it on the next map. So, it's probably 5 to 7 hours uphill.
This is like 30 miles.
18 miles to Gibeon, which is another city that's close. It is a lot of hiking uphill. So, yeah, you're going to see some significant, like, these guys are tough, and they're going to march a ton in really, really tough terrain. So, this is like marching in Afghanistan, right? These are not big open fields.
Across the mountain belt, right?
Yeah, they're across the Jordan, but they're sitting now at the foot of the mountains.
Right.
So all these ascents, Adumim, the way the wilderness, these would have been wadis cut in between the big mountains, right? So that's the only way up. So they would have walked through these natural paths or whatever, okay? So that's how they got up and down, okay? So they're going to take again 30,000 total men to go fight, and they're going to divide their forces in between the 25,000 that are going to kind of be out in the open as a decoy, and then Joshua's going to send 5,000 men behind the city to the west of Ai in the rocks and hiding that are going to come out. Okay, it's a really cool battle plan. Verse 12, he took 5,000 men with him and ambushed and set them between Bethel and Ai on the west side of the city. Then he stationed in 13 all the army on the north side of the city and its rear guard on the west side of the city. So it takes the 30,000, 25 in the open, 5,000 in hiding. Okay, and then watch what he does. Verse 14, it came about that the king of Ai saw it. The men of the city hurried, rose up early, and went out to meet Israel in battle. He and all his people appointed to the appointed place before the desert plain, but he did not know that there was an ambush in the city behind them. So Ai, this king, sees 25,000 men out in the open. Like literally they spent the night out in this open area, and then they realize that's all they got? Like we can take these guys right now. So they hustle out of the city. Verse 15, let's pick up there and kind of watch how the story unfolds.
Joshua and all Israel let themselves be driven back before them, and they fled toward the wilderness.
Anybody got a different translation for fled back before them?
Pretended to be beaten.
So how is God going to win this battle? What is he faking? He's faking defeat. He's faking weakness. So they look like a wounded duck. They start running, realizing, oh, we're outnumbered. Everybody run. Okay. So they start running, okay, and it's these prideful, you know, blood hungry, whatever. They realize, okay, we're going to take Joshua down right now. Okay, keep rolling.
All the men of Ai were called to pursue them, and they pursued Joshua and were lured away from the city. Not a man remained in Ai or Bethel who did not go after Israel. They left the city open and went in pursuit of Israel.
Whoops, right? So that is the prideful arrogance of we're going to take these guys down now. Every fighting male is now out of the city. And then Joshua, verse 18, read that.
And the Lord said to Joshua, hold out toward Ai the javelin that is in your hand. For into your hand I will deliver the city. So Joshua held out toward the city the javelin that was in his hand.
Okay, and this is the signal, obviously, to the guys that are waiting in ambush for when they're supposed to come out. So they see Joshua. By the way, they're up in the rocks and the cliffs waiting to see Joshua. So they have a visual of them, but they're hiding in caves. Okay, in this area there would have been tons of great hiding spots. Okay, the men in ambush arose quickly from their place. Verse 19. When he had stretched out his hand, they ran and entered the city, captured it, and quickly set the city on fire. Okay, so they come in, set fire to the city. These guys don't see any of this. They're chasing Joshua, and then they realize those forces stop. They realize, what are they doing? Then they turn and realize, oh gosh, home is on fire, and there's 5,000 dudes now chasing us from the other side. Okay, they are sitting ducks at this point. So fascinating way that God chooses to win this battle. Okay. When the men of Ai, verse 20, turned back and looked, behold, the smoke of the city ascended to the sky. They had no place to flee this way or that, and the people who were fleeing to the wilderness turned against the pursuers. So Joshua now turns back and comes head on to the men of Ai, to the guys doing battle, and the guys in the 5,000 behind them are kind of pushing them in. Okay, 21, when Joshua saw all of Israel, that the men in ambush had captured the city, and that smoke arose from the city, they turned back and slew the men of Ai. So they win this battle here. End of verse 22, no one was left of those who escaped, so the city goes down. They took the king alive, verse 23, and brought Ai, the king, to Joshua. Okay, so we see in verse 24, somebody pick up there.
When Israel had finished killing all the inhabitants of Ai in the open wilderness where they pursued them, and all of them to the very last had fallen by the edge of the sword.
We see 12,000 people in this city. Okay, so as we're talking about sizes of cities, not gigantic. Ai would have been a pretty decent-sized city with that many folks, but they die. Verse 27, Israel took only the cattle and the spoil of that city is plunder for themselves according to the word of their God. So they are allowed now to take the cattle and those sorts of things from the city which God commands. They kill the king in verse 29, and they hang the king of Ai on a tree until evening. Okay, why would you hang a king on a tree?
To let him know you captured him.
Okay, that is a sign of We've won this city. We have your king. We've killed him. However, watch what they do. This is fascinating. End of verse 29. Joshua gave the command, and they took his body down from the tree and threw it in the entrance of the city gate and raised over it a great heap of stones that stands till this day. So they take his body down before evening. Okay. Anybody got a cross reference there in Deuteronomy?
13:16.
I don't know if it's that one. 21:23. Turn real quick to that. I believe that's the right one. Okay. 21:22. If a man has committed a sin worthy of death, and he is put to death, you shall hang him on a tree. His corpse shall not hang, verse 23, all night on a tree. You shall surely bury him the same day. For he who is hanged is accursed of God, so that you do not defile the land which the Lord your God gives you as an inheritance. So it was Deuteronomy 21, verses 22 and 23. Okay, so in a sense, it was disrespectful to hang somebody into the evening. So you took them down, you gave them a proper burial. Very good. Yes. Right, so this is you see part of the desire of them wanting to get Jesus off the cross was to honor the words that were written in Deuteronomy. Okay, so no, he doesn't hang into the evening. So he's on the cross for 6 hours total, from 9 to 3. Yeah. But that was commanded. Now we're gonna see later on. A king who dies, whose body is hung on the side of a city. And because the people that took him and killed him aren't Jewish, they leave his body up there rotting. And some of the Jews are so offended by that, they go on like a SEAL Team 6 like night raid and take his body off of the city wall, the city they were defeated from, and march his body back home. Like, they go into like literally the jaws of death to go honor their fallen king. Okay, and we're going to see that story begin actually in the book of Joshua and completed later on underneath the king that dies in the Samuels. Okay, so fascinating text. So commanded by God, you don't leave a body up overnight. Okay, you can tout your victory, but you're not going to dishonor the fallen, if you will. Okay, so even though they were guilty. Okay, so they got to take plunder of the land, which, man, again, is so unfortunate, having seen just what happened with Achan. Had they just waited and been patient and trusted the Lord, there certainly would have been rewards coming, but God had a plan for them that they didn't like, okay? Josh would be good. I'm still waiting for Joseph to be done right. That's the movie I want to see, so don't let Hollywood get a hold of it and jack it up. So, how about this? Verse 30, chapter 8, Joshua built an altar to the Lord, the God of Israel, on Mount Ebal. Does that ring a bell to you guys? Mount Ebal and Mount Gerizim. What are those? Very good. Okay, you remember Moses was told when you get into the land, one of you guys get on Mount Ebal, the other group of you guys get on Mount Gerizim, and you shout the blessings and the cursings of Deuteronomy back and forth to one another. This is the area where those mountains are in. They're by Shechem. And God is now going to stop through Joshua and read that. Okay. 33, all the Israelites with their officers and elders and judges standing on both sides of the ark before the Levitical priest carry the ark of the covenant of the Lord. Half of them stood on Mount Gerizim, half stood on Mount Ebal, just as Moses, the servant of the Lord, had been commanded, first to bless the people of Israel and after to read the cursings of the law. So Joshua stops and literally does what's commanded in the book of Deuteronomy in the midst of these battles. Okay, so fascinating piece. Deuteronomy? It's in there somewhere. I've got 27, 11 through 14. I got a cross-reference. Try that. If it's not there, maybe Deuteronomy 11. I think it's 27. That makes sense. Is that it?
Yeah.
Okay, cool. So, we're two battles in, right? We've taken down Jericho. We had a big oops with AI, and then we got a redo. Okay, AI 2. God leads them into victory in the battle, okay? So, chapter 9 now, we're going to see the southern conquest of the land. Something I want you guys to notice. All right. Joshua's going to be really smart as to how he divides this land, okay? You've got a group of kings all down south, and you've got a group of kings and cities all up north, okay? Instead of coming from the south, which would have been the most natural way into the land, right? How they come from the way that like maybe Abraham and those guys traveled, you would have come and done battle with these kings down here, and you would have hit Telerod, which is down here, some big, big fortified cities coming out of the Negev, okay? What's the problem with that, battle strategy-wise? If you don't divide the land in half, what does the north have the ability to do for the south? Come and help, right? All these guys are going to come down and help. Well, instead, what they do is they come across kind of the midpoint, and they're going to do battle in the south, and they're cutting off, if you will, resources, supply chains, and help from the north. After they win the southern battles, then they're going to turn their attention north and go do battle up there, okay? So God, in his infinite wisdom, has them go into the cities this way, okay? So an odd way to get in, but strategically it actually makes a ton of sense, okay? So we're going to see in chapters 9, 10, 9 and 10 is the southern conquest, okay? And then chapter 11 is the northern conquest. We just get three chapters on all the battles, right? We get half the book on the dividing of the land. Three chapters on the battles, okay? And the battles occur over probably at least a seven-year period. So as we read this, it sounds like it all goes really fast. These battles take almost a decade to complete, okay? So just for perspective, okay? Now, chapter 9, verse 1, let's pick up there.
As soon as all the kings who were beyond the Jordan in the hill country and in the lowland all along the coast of the Great Sea toward Lebanon, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Canaanites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites heard of this.
All the ites, okay? Keep rolling.
They gathered together as one to fight against Joshua and Israel.
All right, that's smart. We're going to lose if we all fight individual battles. We're not friends, but we all have a common enemy. So today, we're all on the same team. So let's gather up against Joshua and his forces, and let's go fight them together. So they rally the troops. Now, because you guys have got some good education on the land, tell me if a word sticks out in here. All the kings, chapter 9, verse 1, beyond the Jordan, in the hill country. Where's the hill country? It's the Judah Mountains, right? And in the lowland. What's the lowland? Low hills. Shephelah, that word in Hebrew is Shephelah, okay? So geographically, these are why we taught you some of these things. So they're saying from the coast to the Shephelah to the Judah Mountains, all the kings everywhere that lived in the southern region all got together, okay? And they are now going to go do battle against Joshua, okay? That is their plan. Their plan, that's part of at least some of these kings' plans. The guys in verse 3 have a different plan.
But when the inhabitants of Gibeon heard what Joshua had done to Jericho and Ai, they on their part acted with cunning and went and made ready provisions and took worn out sacks for their donkeys and wineskins, worn out and torn and mended.
Okay, so these guys from Gibeon hear what Joshua has done to Jericho and Ai. All the other kings say, hey, let's all get together to battle. The Gibeonites say, no, we're going to do something different. We are going to be crafty. We're going to take out worn-out wineskins, worn-out and mended and patched sandals on their feet, worn-out clothes for themselves. All the bread of their provision had become dry and crumbled. What are they doing? They're about to come to Joshua. Yeah, they're going to try to make a peace treaty, if you guys know the story. What's with all the worn-out stuff? Yeah, make them look like from their a really far-away land. Why would that matter?
And they're not from Israel.
They're not from Israel. They're not from Canaan. What did God say to do to all the people that were in Canaan? Kick them out of the land. And do not make a covenant with them. Don't marry their daughters. Don't worship their gods. Right? Kick them out. But if they're from really far away, say like Iraq, you know, in Babylon or Sumer, that's not your land. Make a covenant with them. Live in peace. That's fine. So these guys come craftily with their worn out wineskins and their blown out sandals. They're like, hey, we're from like really far away. We've been on this really long journey. And that's what they do. Okay, they came to Joshua at Gilgal and said to him in verse 9, "We have come from a far country. Now therefore, make a covenant with us." So they bold-faced lie to Joshua. Okay, so the men of Israel, verse 9, said to the Hivites, "Perhaps you were living within our land. How then shall we make a covenant with you?" So immediately they suspect, something could be awry here. You guys could be lying, filthy dogs. But we don't know. Okay? Verse 8, keep reading.
They said to Joshua, "We are your servants." And Joshua said to them, "Who are you? And where do you come from?" They said to him, "From a very distant country your servants have come because of the name of the Lord your God. We have heard the report of him and all that he did in Egypt, and all that he did to the two kings of the Amorites who were beyond the Jordan, to Sihon, the king of Heshbon, and to Og, king of Bashan."
I dare one of you to name your kids Sihon or Og. That'd be awesome. You gotta call him that, whatever. You know, it's, you gotta come here, Og. What did Jimmy name his kid? Og. He's gonna be tall.
Scott Og.
It's got a good ring to it. Scott Og, get down here right now. Sorry. What do these guys say to Joshua? What are they doing?
They're lying.
Lying, but how? What are they playing to in Joshua?
They're trying to be servants.
We heard of God.
Yeah, tell me more about that.
They're trying to use that as an excuse to.
So why would that appeal to Joshua? What specifically? Your God, and specifically what's happened? All the battles that you've won, Joshua. You're a commander. You're a big deal. We've heard it, right? They're placating to his pride. I guess I have, right? So they're brown-nosing, obviously. They're smart, but they're placating to a man's pride. They hear this. "All the elders of the inhabitants of our land," in verse 11, "spoke, saying, take provisions from your hand to the journey. Go to them, meet them. We are your servants, make a covenant with us." Man, we know y'all are a really big deal. So we want to be like on the same team as you. We've got no beef with you, but we certainly don't want to go to battle with you because you would beat us in battle, right? It's silly. So, man, when we came, verse 12, "our bread was warm, our provisions were good, our wineskins were filled with new wine, but now we're here, and man, everything's worn out because we came from a really far place, Joshua." Where? Really far away, Joshua. Well, where exactly? Distant. Like, right? They know something smells awry, but they don't look into it, okay? Verse 14, "the men of Israel took some of their provisions and did not ask for the counsel of the Lord." So Joshua looks at it, goes, man, something seems off, but gosh, these guys seem nice enough, and they know our God, and okay, 15, "Joshua made a peace covenant with them and let them live. And the leaders of the congregation swore an oath to them." Joshua now commits his word to the Gibeonites. Some of the Ites living in the land that Joshua was commanded to eradicate, he makes a covenant with them and promises them, okay, we're going to live in peace. And guess what happens when you give your word according to the word of God? It's done. You don't get to undo it. You don't get to say, oh, you know what? I was having a bad day. Or, hey, I misread that. Hey, or y'all a bunch of filthy lying dogs. This contract's null and void. God says, you're going to stand by that, okay? You gave your word, and you're going to stick by it. And the disheartening part of it is Joshua gets played. His pride gets appealed to. He doesn't consult with the Lord. He feels like something's off, but he doesn't stop and say, hey, give me 10 minutes. I need to go have a conversation with the guy real quick. Hey, God, something seems off here. Are we okay to make this covenant? And God would have said, oh, heck no. No, those are the Gibeonites. They're lying dogs, you know? He would have figured it out, but he doesn't. So, bit of a Peter, ready, fire, aim, and he's going to regret it later on, okay? And you're going to see how serious God takes this covenant. This isn't just, hey, live at peace with them. In the coming chapters, you're going to see it gets gnarly, okay? Chapter 10, actually, okay? So, they make a peace covenant with them. Now, they do, in verse 21, it says, "The leader said to them, let them live. They shall become hewers of wood and drawers of water for the whole congregation, just as the leaders had spoken to them." So they put them in certain cities. 18, the sons of Israel did not strike them, but they make them kind of their, they said, hey, we're your servants. And they said, fantastic, we need some servants. That's great. We got a lot of heavy lifting to do. Where would you chop wood and get water? hill country potentially, maybe in people's houses. What else in Israel needs water and I'm probably not giving you guys an answer. The idea is they probably put them as servants to the priests, stuck them over by the tabernacle and said, man, chop wood for the altar. You're going to be around the things of God. Like if we can't make a treaty with you, then we're going to at least make you, or if we can't kill you, we're at least going to make you become workers. Okay. So anyway, they get word of this. Verse 27, you see it again, but Joshua made them that day hewers of wood, drawers of water for the congregation of the altar of the Lord. So they get stuck in the tabernacle having to do the Lord's work. Okay? Yeah.
Did they put them there because it was like the least looking place to people who would possibly try and follow their gods or maybe try to work over?
I think kind of it's part of it's like, yeah, we're going to put you on the things of God all the time. So you want to be lying dogs to us? By the way, we found out in verse 16 that you guys were lying dogs. 3 days later, they find out. Dude, you're actually our next door neighbors. You're not from a distant country. You lied. They said, great. You want to lie to us? Guess what you're going to do? You're going to roll speaker cable in the church around Christians all day long. And you're going to be right? So I think they put them kind of in the believing community, if you will, around the Levites. Okay? So Joshua finds out. Yep, blew that one. 3 days later, he gets word that these guys are indeed, they live in the land and they can do nothing of it. Okay? But doesn't lay a hand on them. Commits his word to him and says, hey, we made a treaty. I'm good to my word. That's how God interacts with us. I can't undo it. So here we are. Go chop wood in the tabernacle. Okay. Now, chapter 10, verse 1. Okay, the kings that we read about earlier that realized, hey, if we don't come into battle together, same king. Derek, I won't make you read all these names. Okay, 10:1 came about when Adonai Zedek, the king of Jerusalem, this is a wicked king. So currently, when you hear about the Jebusites are the people that live in Jerusalem. This is their king, Adonai Zedek, whatever you say, however you say his name. Okay, they heard that Joshua captured the city, and Ai utterly destroyed Jericho and its king. All the inhabitants of Gibeon had made peace with Israel and were within the land. So these coalitions of kings that were trying to get together and fight find out that they had a defector. And that defector was Gibeon. And Gibeon has now made a peace treaty with Israel. Now, Gibeon is not an insignificant city. And they realize, whoa, wait a second. Israel's a really big deal. Gibeon's a pretty big deal. And now they're on the same team. This is bad news. So they say, let's go attack Gibeon. Okay, that's the plan. So you defected. You went from shirts to skins. We're not. And we're going to attack kind of our own brethren. Okay, so they feared Gibeon. They mentioned that in verse 2. They had mighty men. Therefore, verse 3, Adonai Zedek, king of Jerusalem, sent word to Horam, the king of Hebron, to Piram, the king of Jarmuth, the king of Lachish. Heard that city before? Gezer, Bet-Shemesh, Azekah, Lachish, one of the gateway cities into Jerusalem. I'll show you that in a second. And Eglon. And he says, hey, verse 4, come up to me. Help me now, and let's attack Gibeon, for it has made a peace treaty, or made peace with Joshua and the sons of Israel. So they're going to attack their own, one of their own cities, because they defected, okay? So, read this now in verse 5. This is interesting.
Then the five kings of the Amorites, the king of Jerusalem, the king of Hebron, the king of Jarmuth, the king of Lachish, the king of Eglon.
Gosh, I did it to you anyway, didn't I, Derek? I'm sorry. read the end of verse 5.
Gathered their forces and went up with all their armies and encamped against Gibeon and made war against them.
So they go to war. Man, they gather all their troops. They don't fight Israel. They fight the defector Gibeon. Okay, this is funny. Then the men of Gibeon sent word to Joshua to the camp at Gilgal saying, do not abandon your servants. Come to us quickly and save us and help us. For the kings of the Amorites that live in the hill country have assembled against us. What? What do the Gibeonites now ask for?
Help.
Y'all are lying, filthy dogs. You just made a covenant with us and you lied to us. And as a result of the lying, we made a covenant with you. You're not our friends. You're our enemies. And now you have the audacity to ask us to help you in battle against the kings that you were on their team 3 days ago? Are you kidding me? That's what they're asking. Verse 7. What? Joshua went up from Gilgal, he and all the people of war with him, and all the valiant warriors. They leave camp to go help the Gibeonites. Do you see how seriously God takes their word? Hey, listen, Joshua, you committed to them. You made a covenant with them. You're going to live at peace with them. It's not just about, you know, free labor. They need your help. You guys are on the same team now. Go help. And this is not an insignificant battle. Yeah, Sean?
I don't understand why. I mean, I get that Israel needed to treat them now as, you know, like not defeating them. But why does God force them to also defend them? Like, why not just allow their enemies to duke it out, wipe out Gibeon, even though it was a mistake on behalf of Israel? It's not like Israel would have done it.
Yeah. I think it's the nature of the covenant and how strong God takes that language. Not only are you not enemies, you're now our friends. You're now on our team. So this is just
love
like
our neighbor as ourselves.
In a way, right? This is, you are, you're as if you're an Israelite now. You got grafted in a sense, right? You don't worship our God, but we're going to treat you as such. So, it's bizarre.
I really see the gospel of that story in that we are our all those offenders, and we come and we lie and we cheat and we make it like, oh, I'm going to totally serve you, I'm going to believe you, I'm going to, and then we go and we do our own idol worship, we do our own thing, yet God still keeps his covenant and what he promised.
It's good.
And he's like, oh, you're needed help now. Yeah. You went and got yourself in. You were in trouble.
It's good.
And he comes and he's good. All right, I'll take care of you.
The gospel in the book of Joshua, man.
You recognize, I don't know what the end of the story to get in is, but like we recognize, wow, God is really in work in our lives.
Yeah.
So I see the gospel in the story.
Yeah, I think it's a great observation, Joseph. Well said. Absolutely. Okay. So Joshua goes in verse 7 from Gilgal, he and all the people. Okay, this is where they go from Gilgal up to their camp at Gilgal into Gibeon. Okay, so they go from Gilgal is here. Here's Gibeon. By the way, there's Ai. So their first battle, they rode up this way and then took a turn to the right. Okay, now they're going to Gibeon. This is where the Gibeonites are. And all these kings, by the way, are now assembled together. And they have come in to fight against the Gibeonites. Okay, so again, seven-hour probably ascent, 18 miles, 3,500 foot ascent through some pretty difficult stuff.
How long did it? Because obviously they sent the message, and so did they send that message while they were in battle? So that, how long did it take Joshua to get there?
Probably overnight. They probably sent a runner down to the camp. Gave the message, and then Joshua's got a decision to make. So he gets it at evening, and they march. God says in verse 8, don't fear, I've given them into your hand. Verse 9, Joshua came upon them suddenly by marching all night from Gilgal.
Oh.
So they do a midnight march all night. It's still dark when they get there.
And the war's still going on?
Yeah, it's not hot. No, it's almost like they give him a break, right? And we're going to see this a couple times in Scripture, okay? If you've got someone that's going to come rescue you, we'll see this with Israel later on, they'll kind of give them a respite. So, and if they want to come fight, let them come fight. So for whatever reason, I think they get a break in the battle, okay? So, but Joshua surprises them, okay? And they march all night long. Verse 10, now think about that. You've just marched all night long. What do you want to do as a warrior at this point? You want to take a nap, right? Okay? Yeah, he's not screwing around. Okay, verse 10.
He's 60 years old.
Yeah, he's probably at this point, he's probably in his 70s. We're going to see in chapter 12, 13, 14, something like that, Caleb is 85 at the end of these battles. Okay, and they're probably about the same age. So this is not some 32-year-old, you know, battle-hardened, I've been in the Marines for 12 years. This is an older guy, and he can get with it. So, verse 10, the Lord, listen to this. Here's how the battle goes. The Lord confounded them before Israel, and he, the Lord, slew them with a great slaughter at Gibeon and pursued them by the way of the ascent of Beth-horon and struck them as far as Azekah, Bet Shemesh, Azekah, Lachish, drives them all the way back to one of the gateway cities at Makkadah. Verse 11, it came about as they fled before the Lord that they were at the descent of Beth Horon. Okay, this is, again, one of the pathways out, one of the few places you could go, the Beth Horon Ridge. It's in the map. As they fled before Israel, the Lord threw large stones from heaven on them as far as Azekah, and they died. There were more who died from the hailstones than from those who the sons of Israel killed with the sword.
That air support.
Then Joshua spoke. That's exactly what that is. Can you imagine? Like the only people with airplanes? Like, you're all going to die. God throws stones from heaven. We haven't seen stones thrown from heaven since Sodom and Gomorrah, right? And that was a whole different situation. So do you see how seriously God takes this covenant that Joshua makes? God's now involved in the battle and kills the enemies even. So last chapter, God's faking weakness like some wounded doe dying, right? And that's how they win AI. This time, God's now on the offensive and he's chucking stones from heaven. And that's how they win this battle. And it gets better. Joshua spoke to the Lord in the day when the Lord delivered up the Amorites from before the sons of Israel and said, O sun, stand still at Gibeon. O moon in the valley of Elon, verse 13, so the sun stood still and the moon stopped until the nation avenged themselves from their enemies. Joshua prays that there would be more daylight, that the sun would stand still in the sky until they could finish the battle. So the sun stood still. Like, y'all figure this out. I don't know. Did God, like, stop the earth from moving? I don't know. But somehow, God delays the sunset, and they continue to win this battle. Okay? End of verse 13, and the sun stopped in the middle of the sky and did not hasten to go down for about a whole day. 14, there was no day like that before it or after it when the Lord listened to the voice of man, for the Lord fought for Israel. Joshua and all of Israel returned after the camp at Gilgal after defeating these five kings. Are you kidding me? Like, that's how this battle goes down. God says, it's my land. I care about it, and I'm going to do battle different ways every time. What are you learning about God, by the way, in terms of how he fights? Now, he ain't screwing around. He's going to win. Is it like same plan every time, this is how we do it? No. You don't have a clue what God's going to do today. Okay, today you're going to fake weakness. Today, that's how you're going to win the battle. Okay, tomorrow, I'm going to throw rocks from heaven. The day after that, we're going to go on the offensive. It's God's just different every way that he does it. It's fascinating to me. Yeah. Whack! Yeah, you're waiting up here, and then all of a sudden you get one in the stomach, right?
Is that how those stones, you know how people go visit that monument, that they're like laying across in a circle?
Yes, in Scotland. That's how they got there. Just all I saw was Tiana go like this. Just all the bun move.
I think it's incredible that God does. I mean, he's a creator, obviously, so anything's possible. But like, even in the time of Noah, we were going through Noah, where he's talking about the destruction and that, you know, water is going to come and fill in this boat. Like, they'd never even heard of rain. Like, they didn't even seen rain before, and then he sends rain. We're obviously familiar with rain now, but, like, I've never seen rocks fall from the sky, and it's not something you can really plan for. Like, what kind of shields do you have to build for that?
Speaking of Texas, I have been personally in a baseball size hail. Insane.
Baseball size?
You get the heck inside really fast. You get hit in the head with baseball-sized hail, it can be fatal. There are stories of softball-sized hail in places in Texas. I've never seen it personally. I've seen pictures of it. All over Texas, man. Yeah, you get it there, but, man, we'll get it in Dallas. Man, we get freaky weird weather. I don't know. Earthquakes or tornadoes, I'm not sure which I prefer, but they both suck. We get weird weather. So, if you're out in your car, like, they have hail sales at car lots.
What? What's that?
Whole lot got hammered by hail, right? Every car that's outside, all 600 vehicles. If you're a car dealer in Texas, you have hail insurance. All right, everything's on sale. Hail sale. Literally, and you'll see signs come up at dealerships 3 days after a big hailstorm, and they'll have guys on site like the dent puller guys. Oh, we get a couple of those out. Windows get smashed. I mean, it's insanity, but that's part of the stuff you have to prepare for in Texas. That big, I would say maybe once a decade, but we get hailed on
everything's bigger in Texas.
Every other year. It's true. It's truth. Yeah, that's right. Size of puppies. Oh my gosh. We are derailed. Alright. Back to the text. Maybe we should just all go home now. Sorry. All right. Now, verse 16, chapter 10. The five kings fled to a cave at Makkedah, and they hid themselves in a cave. Joshua says, great, your cave is now going to be your tomb. Verse 18, they roll stones against the caves that they went and hid in, and now they're stuck there. They bring them out in a couple days. They destroy their cities. They destroy all the towns while these guys are in there. They take the southern conquest this way. So again, you've got all these cities now that are left unexposed. Makkedah is here. So all these cities that came to do battle, they all ran to one cave, the kings at least, and now they went and destroyed all the cities and take the whole southern area, okay, this way. And then they brought the kings out, opened the mouth of the caves in verse 22. They did so. The five kings come out in verse 24. And Joshua says to them, come near, put your feet on the necks of these kings. And that is a sign of complete and total conquest. Lay down, and I'm going to put my foot on your neck, right? That's the picture there is we have won the day, okay? They end up killing the kings. And I forget what verse it is, okay? But they do to these kings, put them to death. And it mentions, to the king of Makkedah, as he'd done to the king of Jericho in verse 28, end of verse 28, verse 30. He did to its king as they had done to the king of Jericho, verse 30. They killed him, king of Lachish, the king of Gezer. They kill these kings, and God takes over the southern area now of the land, okay? So they have now conquered basically the southern portion of the land, verse 40. Joshua struck the land, the hill country, okay, Judah Mountains, the Negev, and the lowland, the Shephelah, and all the slopes of their kings, he left no survivor, but he utterly destroyed all who breathed, just as the Lord, the God of Israel, had commanded. 41, they struck them as far as Kadesh Barnea, the southern edge of the land, as far as Gaza, on the coast, on the west side, the country of the Goshen, even as far as Gibeon, to the far east side of the river. So they have taken now the entire southern portion of Israel, okay, from the coast all the way through the high country down into the ravines and in the Jordan Valley and all that stuff. Joshua and Israel returned to camp now at Gilgal. Okay, so the southern area of the Promised Land has been won.
So, I mean, looking at the map, how do you fit all those people across this entire span when they're a speck on a map?
They're camped at Gilgal now, and they've got apparently some open space. So they're spread out, but they've got enough space to camp at Gilgal, kind of in this area where they're camped closely like they were in the wilderness, same way. And then they'll begin to spread out. So, okay?
Is the tabernacle still moving?
We're about to read about that. Good question. Yes, it's still around, okay? We haven't seen it in a while, but yes, it is still with them.
So it's still that same system where each camp camps in a different spot.
Exactly.
Okay,
so nothing's changed in terms of how they're camping, okay? So they still have the ark. They would have been camped out that way. The ark goes into battle, right, sometimes, so maybe that would change. But yeah, you still camp the way that we camped in Numbers 1 through 10 when God gave those instructions, okay? So now we're going to go north, okay? It came about, chapter 11, verse 1, that Jabin, king of Hazor, heard of it. He sent to Jobin, king of Madon, king of Shimron, and the king of Oxaph, and the two kings who were in the north in the hill country. So these guys find out, oh gosh, the southern coalition just got demolished. We're next. He sends out word to the south, to the Arava. He's getting all kinds of help. That's not the map I want to show you. Where's the north? Here we go. So this guy, Hatzor, is right up north of the sea. Here's Hatzor. Okay, this is the guy that instigates everything. He's the biggest king. This site is gigantic, by the way. Okay, huge archaeological finds here. So he gets the guy from the Arava, this king, king over here on the coast, all the kings of the north, and they're going to assemble together here at the waters of Murom. We're not for sure where that is, but this is where this battle is about to take place. So he's doing the same thing. Everybody combine forces. Let's go. We're now going to attack Joshua. Okay, so he rallies all these troops, all these kings. Verse 4, they came out, all their armies with them, as many people, the sand is on the seashore, very many horses and chariots. Okay, one of the things that Hatzor, H-A-Z-O-R, Hazor is known for, it's a chariot city, meaning later on, this is where Solomon is going to keep all of his chariots, all of his horses. So these guys have even more fortifications in terms of defensible locations and ability to wage warfare. Iron, chariots, okay? These guys are a big deal, okay? They came out, a ton of people, okay? All the kings, verse 5, having agreed to meet to the waters of Merman to fight against Israel. Now, watch in verse 6 what God does. Alex, pick up there if you don't mind. 11:6.
And the Lord said to Joshua, don't be afraid because of them, for tomorrow at this time I will deliver all of them slain before Israel, and you shall hamstring their horses and burn their chariots with fire.
All right, so God says, don't sweat it. I know there's more of them than there were in the south. I'm going to take care of this. And what are you going to do to all their instruments of warfare? What does it mean to hamstring a horse? You cut its hamstrings, literally, okay? And probably put it to death. Why would God say to do that to a horse? You can use it. You got to trust in me to do battle for you, okay? And you're going to burn their chariots, okay? You're not going to put your trust in their instruments of warfare. You're going to get rid of all that stuff, okay? Now, we marched around Jericho. Walls fall down. Israel wins, okay? We go into Ai. God fakes weakness. Looks like they're beat. Defeated. Brings in an ambush from the west side of the city, traps the people of Ai in between, okay, and through weakness wins the battle. Watch how God goes about this one. Verse 7.
So Joshua and all the people of war with him came upon them suddenly by the waters of Merom and attacked them.
Whoa. So all these kings are gathered. They're ready to go to battle, and what does God have them do? Israel is now on the offensive and attacks them. Surprise attack, okay? So different every time. Verse 8, watch how this battle goes.
The Lord delivered them into the hand of Israel so that they defeated them and pursued them as far as Great Sidon, Misrephoth, Maim, and the Valley of Mizpah to the east, and they struck until no survivor was left to them.
So they win this battle just like that. The whole north is won in 9 verses. Okay, Joshua did to them just as the Lord told him in verse 9. He hamstrung their horses and burned their chariots with fire. Joshua turned back at that time and captured the king of Hatzor, struck its king with a sword, for Hatzor formerly was the head of all these kingdoms. So he takes down all the kings, and Hatzor, the king, the big, strong, tough guy, verse 11, destroys everything, burns Hatzor with fire, one of the only city in the north. According to verse 13, Israel did not burn any of the cities that stood on their mounds except Hatzor alone. Joshua burned with fire. Okay. Verse 14, all the spoil of these cities and all the cattle the sons of Israel took as plunder. They struck every man with the edge of the sword until they were utterly destroyed, until no one who was there breed. They get rid of everything. Okay. So in literally 15 short verses, you get the description of the entire battles of the north. Okay. Now, those are the major battles. There's still some skirmishes that need to take place, okay? You see in 16 and following, my chapter headings is a summary of the conquest. Joshua now goes into the hill country, to the Negev, to the land of Goshen, to the lowland, the Arava, all over. They're still putting out fires, if you will, to conquer the rest of the territories. Verse 18, it says, Joshua waged war a long time with these kings. Probably 7 years. He spends continually putting down these skirmishes. So the initial battles in the south and the north are pretty quick, but finishing the job now takes time. Okay, so the first period was probably done over months, and then this summary, if you will, and all the things that have to take place, the whole span of it is 7 years. Okay, I think, Kyle, you asked about this yesterday, about the giants in the land. Who asked about that? Was it you? Read 21. 11:21.
At that time, Joshua went and destroyed the Akanks and Akanks from the hill country, and from Hebron, Debris, and Anab, and from the hill country of Judah, and from the hill country of Israel. Judah totally destroyed all of them and their towns. No Akanites were left in Israelite territory. Only Gaza, Gath, and
Ashdod. Okay. Mine says the Anakim, okay? Those are the big, strong, tough guys. So there's a couple left in the land. Not all the cities had them, but those are the big boys. Okay, notice where they're left. The Anakim, the giants of the land. The sons of Israel wiped them all out, except only in Gath, Gaza, and Ashdod. Who do we know that old King David's going to meet who's from Gath? Goliath, okay? So he is one of those guys that their clan did not get exterminated or pushed out of the land either way. They stayed and lived in the land on the coast. Gath, Ashdod, and Gaza are all Philistine cities. Okay, we'll see more of those to come, but they did not get wiped out. Okay, so that's the story. So they finish, at least in the main portion of the land, they push the people back, and it's a decent start. Chapter 12 and following is a bit of a review of the land that was taken and all the kings that were defeated. Verse 7, it says, now these are the kings of the land whom Joshua and the sons of Israel defeated. Look at verse 24. Every king that's listed from 7 to 24 is every king that goes down in battle. 24, the king of Tirzah, 1, and in all, 31 kings. Okay, so I guess to be correct, there's not 31 battles, but Joshua takes down 31 different kings of cities. Is that right? Kings of cities, yes. Okay, so 31 different cities go down at the hand of Joshua and God. Okay, so we have now taken, if you will, the entire area of Canaan. Okay, they've defeated the south, they've defeated the north. They've won the battles, if you will, or they've won the war, but they haven't won all the individual battles that they need to. Okay, this is where Joshua is going to start getting hot mad. Okay, initially they have been obedient; they've walked with God. Okay, in 13:1, now we're going to begin to divide the land. Okay, let's pick up there.
While Joshua was old in advancing years, and the Lord said to him, "You are old in advancing years, and there remains
years." It's always funny to me too. It's like, what? You just told us he was old in advancing years. You were old and advanced in years. Okay, clearly. He is probably 90 to 100 years old, by the way, at this point. Okay? Joshua's old. He ain't messing around. Like, buddy, you need to stop doing battle. Okay? Take it easy. So, this is the land that remains. All the land of the Philistines. Where is the land of the Philistines? Coast. Very good. And all those of the Gershurites. So, there's some ites that are still living in probably the Judah Mountains that are still there. And he walks through some of the cities that are still around. Verse 3, the five lords of the Philistines, the Gazite, Ashdod, Ashkelon, Gittite, Ekronite. Okay, those are all cities, okay? Gath, Ashdod, Gittites, that's Gath, I believe. And in those cities on the coast, and he walks them through. These are the cities you need to finish doing battle with. Okay, you've won the big war, but there's still skirmishes that need to put out. You're not done, okay? God says in verse 6, I will drive them out before the sons of Israel, give Israel their allotted land. I will do my job, but my finishing the battle is contingent upon your obedience, okay? I'm not delivering them to you on a silver platter. You've got to go obey and fight, and if you fight, I'll win the battles for you. If you don't, then you get to live in this land, in this condition, okay? And they're going to take the easy way out. 8 and following, now they're going to divide the lands trans-Jordan, okay? They're going to now give the Gibeonites, Reuben, Gad, and the half-tribe of Manasseh freedom to go home. We've won the battles, you've done your job, you guys get to go home, okay? So in 8 and following, they get to go back to their land, okay? So 8 all the way through The end of chapter 13 is all about them heading home and talks about the inheritance that God gave them. And they're good to go. They fulfill their obligation to Joshua. They did indeed fight for these last 7 years, and now they're returning home. Okay. Reminder, last verse of chapter 13, to Levi, Moses did not give an inheritance. They had to now live in the cities, the 48 Levitical cities within the land of Israel. Okay. Now, 14:1, let's pick up there, and they're going to begin the actual dividing now of all the land on the west side of the Jordan. They get scattered against through 48 cities, okay? But what has to happen for a Levite to get a city? There has to be a city, okay? That has to be occupied by Israel, not Gibeonites. So the other tribes have to do their job and finish the battles so that their cities are available. Does that make sense? We're going to see one of them here in just a second in chapter 14, okay?
These are the inheritances that the people of Israel received in the land of Canaan, which Eleazar, the priest, and Joshua, the son of Nun, and the heads of the fathers and houses of the tribes of the people of Israel gave them to inherit.
Okay, so again, they're given by God. Eleazar is mentioned, the priest, and Joshua. These are the two guys that are doling out the land, okay? Moses had given this inheritance, and look who gets to go first. Surprise, surprise, it's the tribe of Judah. Not Reuben, Judah, the recognized leader, is the first one that's divvied up land, okay? Judah's land is down here in the south. I told you it was gigantic, okay? I told you guys it wasn't great land. It actually isn't bad. Some of the stuff in the south is more desert area. This is the Negev. But he's got the edge of Jerusalem is right there. It's actually in Benjamin. Kiriat Yearim, which we go to. Tessa, you remember going there? Did you guys head to Kiriat Yearim? It was probably first stop in your Israel tour. Sean, you remember that town? The Hill of the Wood. City of the Wood, rather. Bet Shemesh. Okay, so some of these towns are pretty lush and good. And they get a big chunk of town. You stay the first night in a... Really? Okay, stop in Tel Aviv?
The first, like, literally the first
night. Wow, okay. Then did you stay at a place called Nevilan?
I remember that first night we stayed, but it was like an hour outside Tel
Aviv. Yeah, yeah. Close to Jerusalem. Anyway, so that's meaningless to the rest of you guys, sorry. But that's going to be part of their territory, okay? So Judah, verse 6, drew near to Joshua in Gilgal, and Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, our boy Caleb, right? The Kenizzite said to him, you know the word the Lord spoke to Moses. Verse 7, I was 40 years old when Moses made this promise to me. 40 years ago in the promised land, God told me through Moses, I'm getting this land. And Caleb says now at 85 years old, verse 10, now behold, the Lord has let me live just as he spoke these 45 more years. So he's 85 years old now from the time that Moses spoke. He says, I'm about to get my land. And Caleb is fired up about getting his land. This guy is bad. Verse 12, this is Caleb's speech. Read that. Actually, pick up in 11, Derek.
I am still as strong today as I was in the day that Moses sent me. My strength now is as my strength was then, for war and for going and coming.
He's 85, and he says, man, I can huck a sword just like I did when I was 40. Bring it. I got some more land to conquer. Bring it. That's just fine, okay? If everybody had Caleb's attitude, boy, we would not have a lot of problems moving forward to the book of Joshua. The problem is they don't. Keep rolling, Derek.
So now give me this hill country of which the Lord spoke on that day. For you heard on that day how the Anakim were there and with great fortified cities. It may be that the Lord will be with me, and I shall drive them out just as the Lord said.
Isn't that a great perspective? Give me the cities that God promised me. You heard that the Anakim were there. Perhaps God will be with me just as like he was with us and took the cities of the Anakim. We're going to knock them out. That's fine. So he's looking at God's past faithfulness to say he's going to do just now what he's done in the past. Bring it. So great attitude. Yeah. Sons of Anak, yeah, same folks. Okay, so there's a few of them left. Joshua, or Caleb rather, is looking back on those battles saying, God was faithful with them, he'll be faithful with me. And he takes down these cities. Joshua blessed him, verse 13, gave him Hebron to Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, for inheritance. Hebron, by the way, is one of the Levites' cities, and it's specifically one of the cities of refuge, one of the six. You guys remember that? Caleb's going to have to go to battle, win the city of Hebron, and then hand it over to the Levites. How about that? Like, he's like, great, like, that's what God wants. I'll go to battle for those guys, and that's going to be their city to live in. I don't even get to live there. And every tribe had issues like that, right? You get to defeat cities and people that were living in them, and you said, come on in, Levites, this is your place to live. Okay, so pretty cool. Let's stop there at chapter 14. We'll pick up on the rest of the doling out of the land and look at kind of the maps next week as to where they end up. And we'll go from there, right? Guys, have a blessed weekend. Be safe. And we will see you on Thursday. Yes, ma'am.
I had a question.
Shoot.